Kamenetsky Brothers, Land of Lakers podcast. Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky, coming to you Monday afternoon, mere hours after the Lakers lose again, but in a new wrinkle, this time in overtime. Denver comes to town. That seemed like a game they might have had a chance. You know, yeah. That was one of those things like, hey, Nick Young's back.
Denver, unfortunately, though, caught a bit of a break getting to tune up some of their issues with an extended trip against the East. That's always good for what ails you. Yeah. And if you need any more proof of that, the Lakers are 2-0 against the East.
They got to play four games in a row against the East, and then the Lakers, which is basically the same thing.
Another tune-up.
Oh, that's just mean. Anyway, so the Lakers lose again. And we have passed the point where Nick Young has magic powers. Like, somehow while he was gone, the horn of a unicorn was sprinkled into his bloodstream or something like that. Unfortunately, Nick Young did not return a magical being who could turn the season around by himself.
Well, I think the problem was, Brian, and he may have been correct, Nick Young, that his swag rubbed off on everyone else. Unfortunately, though, they showered. And once you take a shower and the swag washes off, goes down the drain, you're just left...
How bad do you want it, Andy? How bad do these guys want to be good?
You're left being who you are again.
Yes. Stinky or swaggy.
Right.
Those are your choices.
Damn you, hygiene.
So Kobe played 44 minutes in Sunday's loss. And granted, some of that is goosed by the fact that the game went into overtime. But only 5 minutes of it. He was going to play 39 had they won or lost in regulation. And at practice on Monday, Byron Scott reiterated that Kobe's minutes won't be going down. Instead, he'll plan to rest Kobe more in practice, which makes me ask the question, he wasn't before? instead of lowering his minutes during games. So basically, Byron will now do what everyone else has done. Phil didn't really practice him. D'Antoni, you know, Kobe sat a lot of those practices.
Mike Brown only made him take part in the one-a-days, but not the two-a-days.
So, yeah, except he's going to, I guess, continue playing. The only time Kobe doesn't play 35 to 38 minutes a night, 39, whatever it is when the Lakers are so far behind going into the fourth quarter that even Byron can't justify putting him back in.
Which does mean, to a certain degree, his minutes will be limited this season.
Right, there will be games. There will be games.
They're going to find at least one way.
As I noted during the Dallas game, Rick Carlisle is apparently interested in keeping Kobe's minutes down. And what's funny about this, Andy, and we got some other Kobe stuff to get into, a lot of stuff to talk about over the course of the show, some new segments for people, Andy. New stuff. Fun things.
We've decided to reformat the program a little bit.
A little bit. What's funny about this is it doesn't really matter. If Kobe plays 33 minutes a night, it helps him stay healthy. And obviously, I'd rather watch the team with Kobe on it than without. But it wins and losses, you know, wins and losses, it doesn't matter. They are what they are. It's the stupidity that offends me. That's the part, like where Byron said, when Byron said, we're going to do 30 to 40 minutes, I just assumed, like most people, his answer was like 33 or 32. He just didn't want to say it out loud because if he played 35 one night, he didn't want to, why'd you play him 35, Byron? Apparently, no, he really meant 30 to 40. I'm giving myself about a 20% of the game gap to work with here. That's just stupid.
Well, as we've talked about before, Brian, I'm actually, as much as I find like you, this entire process, it's a charade. It's an absolute
There's
farce.
There's a bit of navel gazing going on
here.
I
mean, it's a farce what is going on right now, not just with Kobe's minutes, but frankly, a lot of this entire season.
You're not necessarily early on board with Byron. You don't consider the first 14 games?
14 games. He's not won me over.
No.
Let's just say Byron Scott has not won me over.
He's still on notice.
Right. There is a part of me, and I've stated this well before the season began, when Byron first brought up the notion of limiting Kobe's minutes, and I said, there ain't no way in hell that's actually going to happen. There's a part of me that feels like if Kobe is comfortable with running his body into the ground, you know, I can understand the logic of They don't have anything to play for this season. They really don't have anything to preserve him for this season. It's Kobe's body. He's only got two more years. And if this is what he wants to do with the end of his career, fine.
It's a very libertarian way of looking at it.
It is. Not to give too much away with how I look at a lot of political elements, but at the same time,
they bought their tickets. No, they knew what they were getting into.
With issues like these, I don't necessarily advocate treating the poor like this. I'm just talking.
It's not my fault they don't have food.
This is also, not to give away too many of my political stances, I don't advocate treating the poor like this, for example. But at the same time, though, it's similar to the way, like, when people talk about, you know, painkillers in the NFL, and, you know, the DEA just recently
went
in.
It's a big deal right now, yeah.
Right. Or, you know, these guys getting shot up to get put out, back out on the field. You know, the players knew what they were getting into. They understood exactly what this is. They made the choice. That may be, but no responsible doctor would actually give them the meds to put them on the field. And that, to me, is the actual issue, not whether or not the players would do it. You know, it's the idea of you're putting them out there on the field, sometimes, I imagine, without them even having the entire knowledge to make these decisions. No responsible coach would do to Kobe what Byron is doing, regardless of what Kobe wants.
Particularly since it doesn't work. I mean, Kobe's percentages in the fourth quarter are atrocious.
And yes, they are.
You know, we've been giggling at this all year. I mean, it was last week or a week and a half ago, whatever it was, where Byron said, you know, they're still bringing Kobe along slowly. What? I can't wait to see what it looks like. I mean, there are, in fairness to Byron, there are 12 minutes a night where he elects not to play Kobe. So, yeah, maybe in that sense he is bringing him.
For now. I mean, at some point they're really going to have to try to dig themselves out of this hole. And that's where you're going to see Kobe's minutes go up.
Where was it where he was playing sick? And he said, you know, Kobe told me he wanted a chance to try to play through. He was like, it might have been San Antonio was a home game, but whatever. Where, you know,
one of the losses.
He was 1-for-14 or something like that.
Yes.
And he said, and Byron said after, he wants Kobe to have a chance to fight through these things. And I wanted to give him that opportunity. And we put that on a Twitter, like basically a giant WTF with all our remaining characters as question marks. I mean, that's basically what we have.
It's like the opposite of a magic tweet. His would have all exclamation points.
And so,
and he'd never question
people
Byron.
Get back to us, Andy, and they're like, well, what would you have him do? What's he supposed to say? No. Thanks, Kobe. We appreciate it, but this is a lost cause. Why don't you go ahead and sit down? You know, we know you're willing to put the effort in. Sit down, for the love of God.
We will name you Employee of the Week.
Right. You know, if whatever it is. But it's the stupidity of it that, because you can't pretend that it has no impact on his ability to get through the season. If that's what they want, and I understand that, he's the player people want to see. He, you know, all of these things. I'm sure Jeannie Buss would like him not to be shelled for 40 games this season.
He is the purple and golden goose.
Yeah, I know some execs at Time Warner want to make sure he's on the court over the course of the year. So it's stupid in that regard. And it's stupid because he sucks in the fourth quarter because he's 36 years old and he's got 20 years worth of mileage on him. And Byron's playing him 500 minutes a game. It's I hate stupidity.
Yeah.
It's the stupidity of it.
It's the approach. It's not necessarily the results, because you and I have been very consistent that outside of trading for a new team, there's really nothing Byron can do to make this team consistently good.
No.
But there are a lot of
issues.
There are
things he could do to make them consistently not as bad.
Right.
But that's we'll get to that another
day.
It's
the issue of approach. What is the game plan? What is the impetus for doing what you're doing? And thus far, it seems like Byron is coaching, when it comes to Kobe's minutes, from either a position of fear, whether you're talking about fear of Kobe or fear of losing.
And that mustache is too strong to be scared of anything.
Fear of losing his job.
Right.
I mean, I'll say this. If Mitch and Jim have not spelled out, you know, in the most clear way possible, your job is safe, they really need to. He's either coaching from a position of fear or a position of delusion. Like, this is actually working. Like, this is actually getting them closer.
It's just it's, you know what it is? It's the same sort of old school macho. Kobe's from my era. He's the last guy who's a holdover. And this is actually something we're going to talk about as the show goes on. You know, this idea, I mean, Kobe really is, in so many ways, a throwback. He's the last of an era.
The last alpha male, as Lee Jenkins from SI recent cover story.
Last in style, you know, last in playing a certain way, last in a certain approach. And Byron is from that place. And I think he sees the two of them.
Well, he's even older school.
Right, but, you know, he sees the two of them as sort of the kindred spirits who are going to show these new Lakers how to win. But anyway, please stop playing him 40 minutes a night. Please.
And
they're hard minutes. It's not like he's just standing out there like Steve Novak playing 40 minutes a night.
Or at the very least, if you're going to play him like this, because as I said, I can get behind it if everyone's just honest about it. Just be honest. You know, but right now there just seems to be this element of fear and delusion that, like you, it drives me insane.
You just said he'll rest when he's dead. I would just respect
like, stop
more.
Acting like a drill sergeant if you're not actually going to uphold your own rules.
Heading into the weekend, Kobe said some interesting stuff. Now, he's sort of talked around Andy a little bit. He's made mention of the contract, and he said many times that he believes that the Lakers, you know, were left with enough flexibility to go sign Carmelo Anthony, for example. They could have made an offer for a max contract player, and so on and so on and so on. But being in Dallas, the reporters asked him at shoot around that morning a little bit more detail about the direct comparisons between him and Dirk Nowitzki. And Kobe said a lot of stuff in this, you know, whatever, however many minutes it was with the media that were all very interesting.
11.
Many of which were true. He talked about how it is really unfair that the owners get to have their cake and eat it too, where they're in a situation where it, for some of the onus is always placed on the player to give back to the organization and financially. Players, you know, great players like LeBron, Kobe, all these guys who are underpaid relative to the amount that they generate. There's no question. I mean, you know, you can't debate that. And yet somehow the player becomes the bad guy if he doesn't leave money on the table while owners are all making profits. And I don't care what they say, post-CBA, new TV deal coming, all these things. They're all making profit. If you can't make a basketball team profitable, you suck. And it's your fault, not the star player. So all of these things, you know, how much money he develops, how you have to protect your worth, all of that kind of stuff, it's all true. But at the same time, there's a huge clash going on here between myth-making Kobe and reality Kobe. That, to me, is the most fascinating part of this whole debate about his salary.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Kobe, in presenting this, he's blurring the issue a little bit because it's not entirely about your owner's ability to either make a profit or avoid paying as much of the tax as possible. Some of this, and in this particular case with the Lakers, it's about cap space and available cap space and fit it, literally being able to make deals that are CBA legal.
Sure, but I mean, but he
but I'm saying he is ignoring that element of it.
But the sense of, you know, if a player doesn't give back, the player is selfish and doesn't care about winning. If the owner, but yet owners kind of skate around this whole luxury tax thing, and there's less of an uproar when an owner doesn't, Clay Bennett doesn't pay in the tax to keep James Harden, than there is when Kobe doesn't give up money to free up another $8 or $9 million to bring in a free agent. And I think that's true.
There is some truth to that. I think that is true. You know, players are more popular, they're more visible, they have higher profile than most owners, other than, you know, Mark Cuban and the late Dr. Jerry Buss. I mean, most owners are people that fans aren't, you know, can't pick out of a lineup.
Quote, public perception puts more pressure on them, meaning the players, to take less money. If you don't, you get criticized for it. It's absolutely brilliant. I have a lot of sympathy for him. He says, I'm not going for it, and I don't think the new Players Association head is going for it either. I'm sympathetic to that position. There's no question. But you can't pretend that all you care about, this is where the Kobe as businessman thing butts up against the winning is the only thing that matters thing. It may be unfair that he has to make that decision, but the myth-making here collides. And I just wonder if in the end he looked at it and said, yeah, okay, we'll leave enough money. Maybe we can attract Melo or something like this. The chances of my team being good, regardless of what I do, seem pretty low. And so if my choice is between the principle of getting everything that I think I am worth or flailing in the dark to be bad anyway, I'll take my extra $14 million.
Well,
I mean, I don't necessarily blame him. He's not wrong for it.
I don't necessarily blame him. And I've said many times, even Brian, as somebody who's been pretty critical of this contract in the sense that it completely, you know, leaves the team hamstrung, Kobe is absolutely within his rights to exercise the leverage that he's built up and earned over the years. I don't think he owes the Lakers anything in terms of a hometown discount. In the same way, and I think unfortunately the Lakers didn't see it this way, they don't owe him anything. I think, you know, they've scratched each other's back a bunch of times over the years. I think they're even Steven.
I think they've scratched everywhere. I mean, every ounce of skin on all parties has been scratched at one point or another.
It's been a very even exchange over the last 19 years. He can prioritize this however he wants. You know, Kobe can do what he wants, but there is a trade-off. And Kobe seems very unwilling to acknowledge the fact that the way he prioritized this, which was the money first, it was. There's
right. And also,
no way
his
around
comments,
it.
Too, and you can go through and read them. Mark Medina has them. I mean, they're all over the place. Baxter Holmes at ESPN wrote them. It does sort of shoot a hole in this notion that there was no negotiation.
Oh, God.
He left, I mean, I don't know who believed that, but he left some money on there, but there was clearly a number that the Lakers had to meet, or this wasn't going to get done.
Kobe
wasn't going to take less.
Look, Kobe blew that narrative open like 48 hours after he signed his extension, because I remember he made some comments about how young players need to understand their true market value and all this stuff that may be true, but that was just the first of many instances where he became the equivalent of a poker player who was exposing his whole cards.
But you still see some of this where people say, well, what was he supposed to do? They just came and dropped the money off at his front door. I mean,
yeah, those people are idiots. Yeah. Those people are absolute fools because, I mean, at that point, what you're saying is we believe that the Buss family and Mitch Kupchak are the absolute worst businessmen and negotiators on the planet, that they would bid against themselves this aggressively and early. It wasn't even December of last year. They would do this
aggressively. People knew.
I mean, that is impossible to believe that they just happened to fall on a number that left Kobe as the highest player in the league at 35 coming off major injuries without even getting an idea from Rob Pelinka what it might take.
You
got to be kidding me.
Yeah, the other part that I do think
I want to say we never bought.
Right. The part that I do think is
go back and listen to old shows.
Undersold on this is the mythology of Kobe. Obviously, winning is above all things. And, you know, nobody tries harder, nobody works harder, nobody plays harder, nobody plays through more pain. And all those things are, I mean, you can't argue that Kobe has a work ethic that is unparalleled, and Kobe has an ability to play with pain that is unparalleled and all this other stuff. The downside of the mythology, though, is that it insists that you must be all of one thing. It's absurd to put Kobe in a position where he would get hammered for prioritizing other things, whether close to equally, you know, in a totality that makes it so winning may be the biggest part of the pie, but it's not the only part of the pie. So I have other things. I have my family to think about. If Kobe really prioritized winning over all things, he would have figured out a way to go to a better team. He prioritized wanting to stay in 20 years on one team. Nobody does that anymore. It's incredibly special. That has incredible value to him personally. I believe that.
Oh, yeah.
And it has value to his brand. It has
no question.
It is a very valuable thing in so many ways. That's a reasonable thing to prioritize above another shot at a title. Not wanting to move your family. I don't know his family. I don't know him. That's a thing to put above it.
I'm guessing Vanessa's not going to Milwaukee.
For example, you know, your
that's my guess.
The principle of getting what you think you're worth is a thing that is a reasonable thing to equate, you know, put in that same mix with winning. And the problem with mythology is that
it can butt up against
reality.
It
makes it so it makes everything binary. You got two choices.
Well, I mean, look,
I don't, you know, it's very, what Kobe chose to do is incredibly reasonable, and I don't begrudge him for it.
I don't begrudge him for it, but I think everybody, whether you're talking about, you know, the Kobe zealots, the Buss family, when they talk about this, at least publicly, I have no idea what they say privately, although I have heard before that it's actually pretty similar to what they say publicly, at least in some ways.
People are always listening.
Or Kobe himself. There is that trade-off, and the trade-off is obvious. And anybody who believes that this did not limit the Lakers' options, to actually have Kobe's salary take up this much cap space in December heading into the offseason. I mean, people talk about this like the Lakers, well, you know, they went after Melo, they went after LeBron, they went after Bosch, they couldn't get these guys. So then they just decided to pay Kobe. They locked up all this space 6 months before free agency began.
Yeah, it has
which,
of course.
But people forget about that. Sends a message. That sends a message in terms of the way people think about the Lakers is, oh, they don't have that much space. They don't seem serious about what they're going to be
Kobe's
doing.
Or that Kobe's not going to play nice.
Right.
You know?
It sends a message when Kobe demands this type of salary under those type of circumstances, and it's a put-off. By the way, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, recruiting tool the Lakers could have had is Kobe taking a salary that sends a message, I need you. I
of course,
need
yeah,
you
there's no
to
question.
Come here. And they miss out on that opportunity.
There's no
Kobe
question.
Misses out on that opportunity. People always ask the wrong question, Brian. They always ask, well, you know, who would they have gotten? Who could they have gotten? The answer is, I don't know. You don't know. I have no idea who they could have gotten if Kobe had maybe taken $15 million as opposed to $24 and then $25 the next year. I don't know who they could have gotten. But I know they would have had more options. I know they could have had different pitches. I know maybe a guy like Melo could have been persuaded if he'd known, all right, you know what? I could sign here, play with Kobe, play with Julius Randle, and they have that much more money to go after someone else. Maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't. I have no idea. But I know they have more options. That I know for sure. It's impossible to argue against that.
Yep.
And that's what the Lakers and Kobe cut themselves off from.
Yeah, there's no question. And so it's a fascinating thing to kind of think, look at how we perceive Kobe, how Kobe plays the game, how he makes his priorities, and whether or not we're correct in criticizing the choices. So
I mean, look,
it's all interesting stuff that I have a feeling we'll be revisiting this summer. When Kobe's contract is still something you're talking about.
Yep.
All right, and it's time now, as we have, let's look around the league, some interesting stories around the NBA, starting here with Nike. Allen Iverson, who was a Reebok guy throughout the course of his career, has protested a Nike shoe. Nike is pulling back on plans for a shoe that honors Allen Iverson after the former NBA superstar questioned whether or not the company could use his old number and team colors while he's still endorsed by Reebok. So it was a Zoom Flight 96 collection. I'm not a shoe guy, but they're
no
basically
idea what
trying
that means.
To recreate a shoe. But throw his number in there on the back heel in the red, white, and blue. The Sixers. And
very obvious what they were doing.
They were going for an Iverson shoe without putting Allen Iverson. It's like the part in the video game where you can't get the one guy to agree to be in the game. And so it's just an anonymous person who kind of looks like the guy and mysteriously has the same statistics.
And more importantly, they were doing this not just without trying to honor Allen Iverson. They were doing it without paying Allen Iverson for the honor.
It does seem, Andy, like they're kind of trying to backdoor it a little bit.
This was ridiculous. You can't do that. You cannot base a shoe off an athlete who has, by the way, a contract with another shoe company. He's been a Reebok guy since he entered and exited the league. I think he has a lifetime contract with Reebok. I mean, this was actually, I don't use this often, Brian, this was outrageous. This is absolutely outrageous. You're supposed to be doing this to college athletes who have no power. You're not supposed to do this to a professional athlete.
Says Nike spokesman Kawan Wilkins in a statement last week.
Who we've met, by the way.
Yes. The Nike has, quote, made a business decision not to move forward with the shoe in the red, blue, and white, purple colorways. Basically, and this is me adding it, we'd like not to get sued.
All right,
moving on.
Hornets forward Jeff Taylor will not, Brian, appeal his 24-game suspension that came as a result of a domestic abuse incident. Many sources told ESPN, other outlets, despite the fact that the new Players Association executive director Michelle Roberts said that the ban was, quote, excessive, without precedent, and a violation of the collective bargaining agreement. Jeff Taylor actually spoke recently to the media and said, quote, I take full responsibility for what happened. My actions were wrong, so I don't care to appeal a decision that was based off my actions being wrong.
Yeah, and I tell you what, the kid went to Vandy. He's a Vandy guy. And while I certainly don't condone what he did, and I'm not in love with the idea that a Vanderbilt guy did this kind of thing,
I appreciate that he's smart enough to understand that you can't appeal this kind of thing. And it's been going on with the Ray Rice stuff, all these things where the Adrian Peterson, where the job of the unions kind of butts up against how the rest of us see the world. Like, you know, is it that? I mean, this was not one of these situations where it's Jeff Taylor and he wasn't adjudicated and all these other things. No, it went through the court process and there was a punishment handed down. And
he pled down to a misdemeanor.
Right. But, you know, this is something that happened. And I think it's great that he understands it, A, and says, I did wrong and I deserve to be punished, and B, that I'm not going to go through and be the guy who appeals on principle. And, you know, what's going to happen?
By the way,
too,
puts his girlfriend through it. I believe it was his girlfriend.
I think so. A girlfriend.
Puts everybody else involved that's close to him through this again.
Yeah, and I just, it's... At some point, we got to go back to the table. The next time a CBA comes up, rewrite the language. But for the time being, it's going to be very difficult, even when they're right. Because the union, for example, of the Ray Rice thing, the NFL has been making this stuff as they go along.
You think?
To say the very least.
You think?
And it's not fair, but it's also very difficult from a PR standpoint to justify defending players in these situations.
I'll tell you what's interesting too about this, Brian, in terms of the PR element that you're bringing up. As awful an incident as this obviously is in a vacuum, to have a domestic abuse type situation that comes up, in a lot of ways, this was the perfect scenario for the NBA. I mean, again, you would never want domestic violence to take place with your players, but inevitably will. At some point, these type of things happen just because they happen in society and all walks of society. So this is going to come up in the league. But the league publicly, especially like you said, after what's gone on with Ray Rice in the NFL, wants to follow suit in a way that looks like they're handling this strong and sending out a message. A guy like Jeff Taylor gives them the opportunity to take a strong stance and create precedent for taking these type of strong stances without it being a circus, because nobody cares about Jeff Taylor.
That's a good point.
I mean, really,
no, it makes
I follow the NBA closely. I barely know who Jeff Taylor is.
He's a good player.
But the point being, though, it didn't become a story at all. And in a lot of ways, if this is going to happen...
Well, it did help that it happened during the offseason.
But
the actual incident happened in the offseason, and so he hasn't been...
Yeah,
somebody,
but so did Ray Rice.
Right, but also the star thing there. But they didn't have to pull Ray Rice off the field.
Right.
I mean, they didn't have to pull Jeff Taylor off the court the same way that Ray Rice was removed from the field of play.
But either way,
Jeff Taylor started that way because they weren't going to put him on until this was all resolved.
Right.
But it's an interesting point.
Chris Kamen, Brian, former Laker. He was famous for lying
that
down
went well.
On a bunch of seats. That was a prediction by the, a signing, by the way, that you and I both predicted would go rather poorly. Turned out we were correct. He conducted an interesting interview with Joe Freeman of the Oregonian, talking about everything from hunting to his teammates.
Yes, he was asked. Joe Freeman accepted questions from readers, and these are the questions that were passed along to him.
And one of them, Brian, I mean, again, this is really an interview you should check out because it really does cover a lot of ground. One of them was whether or not Chris Kamen, who is known for hunting anything and everything that moves, believes in Bigfoot. If he actually believes in the existence of Bigfoot, and as it turns out, Chris Kamen doesn't.
Yeah, he says, quote, I don't know. I'm skeptical about it. You just never have seen a body. I've never seen actual evidence. You've got these doctored up pictures. That's about it. I am very disappointed, Andy, to live in a world where Chris Kamen doesn't believe in Bigfoot. Because if anybody believed in Bigfoot, I assumed it would be Chris Kamen.
Well, Brian, you should be happy, because the truth is, Chris Kamen does believe in Bigfoot. I guarantee Chris Kamen believes in Bigfoot, but he is refusing to admit that he believes in Bigfoot because he wants to put all the other hunters off the set so he can be the one to actually go out and bag Bigfoot.
Well, maybe not, because in the same interview he does reveal that as a hunter he prefers the killing to the catching. And I'm not making that up. He really basically says, if I can find the exact quote, he says, some people don't like killing things, some people do. Everyone's going to agree and disagree. I don't particularly like catching them. I like killing
them. Well,
him.
Brian, he's not bringing in...
He just wants to kill Bigfoot.
He's not bringing in Bigfoot alive. He's bringing in Bigfoot dead. But Chris Kamen wants to be the one that bags Bigfoot. I guarantee it.
It could be it. I hope that's the answer. Finally, Andy, the Memphis Grizzlies, who are your top seed right now, if the playoffs were to start today, Andy, which would be weird and unfair,
except for anybody rooting the Lakers.
Right, because they might get that pick there.
It would actually be wonderful.
All right, so the Memphis Grizzlies beat the Los Angeles Clippers badly on Sunday night, pretty much dominated from start to finish. So the Clippers are 7-5. The Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference are struggling. They've lost, I believe, 4 in a row. Could be 5 at this point. Both, I would say, if you had to make a list, both teams of disappointing early season teams. The Clippers would be on top on the Western Conference. The Cavs would be on top on the Eastern Conference. Which team are you most concerned about?
I would say the Clippers, only because the Cavs play in the Eastern Conference, and there's only so much you actually need to figure out in order to go far in the playoffs in the East. I mean, if they can just get themselves up to respectable, that, by Eastern Conference standards, could at least get you a couple rounds in the playoffs. The Clippers need to actually get their shit together, because the West is just
too hard. Right, they're 7-5, but they haven't played anyone really, and they've played almost exclusively at home.
Right. I mean, right. They have not looked, for lack of a better way of putting it, they haven't looked right. I mean, the only thing I can put my finger on in terms of what I think is holding the Clippers back, I guess two things. One, they need better production at the wing on either side of the ball.
There, put it this way. Losing Chris Douglas Roberts mattered.
Right.
That is not a good thing to have to say, because Matt Barnes has not been great this year. And, I think whether distracted by the divorce that he's going through, or just, coming back to earth a little bit, not fitting him, whatever it is, he hasn't been as good.
And Reggie Bullock may just not be ready, may just not be playing at the NBA level that they need him to right now. They need one of those guys to, at the very least, step up on one side of the ball. The other thing, too, and I want to give credit to Don McLean and Corey Maggette and the other guys with their post-game media coverage. I was watching them after one of their losses. I don't remember which one, but they pointed out the Clippers play pretty slow now. They used to be an up-tempo team, with Lob City, and then there was a point where I think they wanted to add more substance to what they were doing and, gain more of a defensive
identity. Get away from it.
I wonder if they got away from it too much, because they've got guys who really run the floor well, who actually can be unstoppable in that way, including, by the way, Matt Barnes. Matt Barnes, you much rather have him run the floor than spot up and shoot. And I wonder if they've actually gotten away a little bit too far from what they've done well in the past and what's given them success. Yeah. But otherwise, they just don't look right.
Yeah, I think their problem on the wing is a bigger issue. The problem with Cleveland, they'll figure out the offense. They'll figure out how to integrate Kevin Love. I don't know if they're going to be able to improve defensively.
Not without a trade.
Because the personnel just doesn't fit in that way. Miami didn't have a rim protector, but they had a bunch of guys who were so long and athletic on the perimeter. Chris Bosh, could go back and forth, and he's long and athletic, and he's a smart defender. And LeBron is he's a truck out there.
And back in the day,
Wade could move around.
Haslam, Shane
Battier, a lot of guys who were long and nimble. And yeah, they didn't have a guy inside, but they had so much length outside, it made it very difficult for teams to do anything. And so they don't necessarily have that. And it's hard for Kyrie, it's hard for Love to learn how to play consequential defense right away.
Yeah.
Like, that's not something, I'm not saying that they can't do it, because I don't know, but neither one of them have ever been in a position where they needed to. Kyrie has never had to play defense in his professional career. Love, I think, has had moments where it was important, but never really had. So both of them, I think, are going to have a little bit of trouble. There's a reason I picked Chicago to come out of the East this year. Fix it, but that's my feeling. Okay, Andy, moving on now from the NBA to what we call a not sports story. Because it is a story that is not about sports.
No. Ostensibly and not even in reality. It's not about sports.
It's not about sports. That's why we call it that. You may have noticed Andy Taylor Swift on the AMAs yesterday. She performed the Blank Space song, which I had never heard before.
My wife loves that song.
So she did that. She also received the inaugural Dick Clark Award for Excellence. And it's an award that recognizes the pop country singer for being the first artist to have 3 albums debut with more than 1 million sold in her first week.
Wow.
So each one of those 3 albums sells 1 million copies in its first week. That's pretty good.
She's a popular gal.
Whether you like her or you don't like her, that makes her a force of nature. So that is why she's in the news. But the thing that actually caught my eye was something I saw at the end of last week, Andy. Taylor Swift, this according to ET, known for being an open book because she does write about all of her feelings through her lyrics.
One could argue Taylor Swift is an oversharer.
Yes. She also recently told Lucky Magazine, quote, "I don't like showing my belly button. When you start showing your belly button, then you're really committing to the whole midriff thing.
Yeah.
I only partially commit to the midriff thing. You're only seeing lower rib cage," which is why when you see Taylor Swift wearing all the little outfits where like her midsection is showing, you never actually see her belly button. And they have a bunch of pictures on this article which do confirm, in fact, that Taylor Swift never shows anyone her belly button, which I think is kind of entertaining. And I do wonder if this becomes now the great goal of the paparazzi. Like, the paparazzi's new white whale will be Taylor Swift's belly button, and the prize financially for the person who can photograph it will be stupendous.
So this was like in the 70s when everyone was chasing around Kiss to see them without their makeup?
Exactly. This is that. I mean, it's a strange, but I mean, you re-understand now because Taylor Swift says, "I'm never going to show this to you." It's not much different than Taylor Swift saying, "I'm never going to show you my vagina either." And people will want to photograph that too. I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying it's the belly button is now off limits, just like her private nether parts.
Actually, you know what? She's never said that. She's never
Wouldn't
said.
Wouldn't it be weird if she started walking around with a thing that did show off her hoo-ha, but not her belly button?
She never said, "I won't go full frontal." She said, "Just when you're when you start showing your belly button, then you're really committed to the midriff thing." That's a completely separate story. By the way,
maybe we're just not asking the right questions.
By the way, when you start showing your belly button, then you're really committing to the midriff thing is one of the strangest things I've ever heard anybody say in my life.
It's like the Cayman interview where if you hear the sentence completely out of context, "Some people don't like killing things, some people do. Everyone's going to agree and disagree." You're not entirely sure what the conversation's about, but it's a little uncomfortable.
I mean, sure, if you look back in history, there are tons and tons of examples of people who committed to the midriff thing, and it just went so badly. Their lives just fell apart. You know, the world even fell apart.
She has a very wholesome image, despite the fact that all she does is sing about breakups and things like that, and clearly dates.
Yeah. She dates around.
She has a very wholesome image that she's trying to keep up by not going whole midriff.
Look, there is something that is being covered up here, and I don't mean simply her belly button. I mean, there's an issue here, and I don't know if just she's got a seriously fucked up belly button. It's like a half innie, a half outie. I mean, just something disgusting to look at it. I mean, maybe she thinks that her belly button is less sexy than Katy Perry's.
Possible.
Because the two of them always feud.
Katy Perry will go full midriff.
Oh, you know what? Actually, not only did I think that, I did a Google search just to confirm that I was right. You can see Katy Perry's belly button easily. I mean, it's a very simple Google search. I thought maybe, too, she could be throwing a little bit of shade at Katy Perry, basically saying you're trying to show off too much belly button because you're a harlot. Because you're easy, because you're,
right.
You're desperate.
There's Katy Perry's belly button right there.
Yeah, I mean, or like you said, maybe just like ladies, you know, don't do that. She's very chaste.
She's calling her a whore, is what you're saying.
I don't know. I mean, I get it. Maybe she doesn't have a belly button. She was born without one. She's insecure.
That's possible.
she should just shake it off. She should just take her own advice, shake it off. The haters are going to hate.
I found that very interesting, and I do think that it is strange that I guarantee you one of the new prizes in the paparazzi universe is now a photo of Taylor Swift's belly button.
That's going to get into some very weird territory with long lenses.
Possible.
And I don't condone that. I do not condone it. I'm just saying it's where it's going to go, because if she takes that much care to make sure she never goes outside with her belly button exposed, you're going to have to go inside.
Her belly button?
Inside the home that she's in, okay. Or whatever.
I was thinking, you remember the movie Inner Space?
No, it's like
somehow somebody invents a machine that literally takes you into.
No, I don't believe it's going to be Martin Short inside Dennis Quaid or whatever.
Taylor
it was.
Swift's belly button.
No, but I mean, I'm saying I assume.
How do you prove if you're inside it that it's her belly button
anyway?
Well,
maybe I am not giving Taylor Swift enough credit for just how seriously she takes this. I assume that when she's, you know, in her own home, when she's private, in the shower or whatever, at some point the belly button gets exposed. I don't think she's like a never nude, like Arrested Development with Tobias. Yeah. You have to assume at some point
she takes it off. Yeah.
I mean, unless this really is like a religious thing or something.
All right, Andy. So switching gears rather abruptly from Taylor Swift to our person of interest this week, Bill Cosby.
Yeah, that is kind of on a dime, but yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah, what can you do? We maybe didn't think that through tonally when we put the show together, but what are you going to do?
The world happens around us whether we like it or not.
So, by now, everyone knows that Bill Cosby has been accused by multiple women of different sexual assaults dating back into the late 60s. All of this blowing up from a routine from a comedian that at least I had not heard of. Maybe you had.
It's because you're not cool, Brian.
I am not cool. There are comedians that I've heard of, but this wasn't one of them. So, I mean,
it'd be one thing if Gallagher said it.
He's not like Chris Rock. No, this guy.
No, but Hannibal Buress is pretty well known.
Okay.
In that world, he's pretty well known.
But it blows up the guy, a piece of his routine where he talks about Bill Cosby and, you know, the allegations from women that go back to 2004, 2005, 2000, you know, civil suits and things like that. This is not new information.
No, this is decades old accusations. But decades now and decades
now worth. It blows up. And we've just gone through a place where the social media has blown up over Ray Rice in sports. Where, there was a not exactly the same thing, but video and a large social media conversation with Donald Sterling, the cat calling video that was a huge thing a couple weeks ago. All of this stuff has now, that part of the social media world has captured, for lack of a better term, Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
With cause, I might add, it appears. I mean, you get to 20 something women. But it's really it's a fascinating kind of thing about what's going on, and because this stuff's not new, and yet now 20 years later, all of a sudden now it's a thing that seems to be the thing that will end Bill Cosby's career.
I mean, not only is it not new, it's actually not unknown. I mean, these are allegations that have been reported again over decades and decades.
Matt Lauer did an interview with a woman in 2005. It was in People in 2006.
But we live now, and this is what struck me about this, beyond the fact that it's just, again, horrific that Bill Cosby has all these accusations and, now even more women are coming out. But again, it's not that this is something shocking, because I had heard this stuff about Bill Cosby before. It's just the way now this social media echo chamber will dictate what we as a society will care about, what you will all of a sudden become either outraged or moved by, or something will connect with you emotionally, and you will damn well have an opinion about it. And I think there's been no better example about that than, about a year ago or whatever, when that PR rep, Justine Sacco, who got on a plane going to Africa and made a very inappropriate joke about Africa and AIDS. And by the time she landed, this was an absolute viral explosion.
Yeah.
She had lost her job. Rightfully, I might add, because if you are in PR and make this type of
she's
joke.
She's obviously terrible at her job.
Right. You make this type of joke over Twitter, you deserve to lose your job. But the bigger thing to me that struck out was how upset people, tons and tons of people, strangers I saw on Twitter, losing their minds over a woman they had no idea existed telling an off-color joke. But once something hits that social media echo chamber and it gets trapped in there, that is the way the world now works. Your mind will be trained to have an opinion about this, to have an emotional reaction about it, and this becomes the way we just communally think now. This is the way we approach the world.
Malcolm Gladwell wrote about the tipping point, and obviously there are all kinds of things that are said on the internet, that are posted on the web, that are sent out over Twitter, and 99.9% of them don't go viral, so to speak. Certain stories catch on, certain stories don't, but the Donald Sterling thing, that became something that the NBA had to act on, in part because sponsors were going to start to pull out, because there were going to be repercussions of if they didn't. And quite frankly, I'm sure it was something that they would have loved to have
do anyway. Get rid of Donald Sterling, great. Bring in, if you could trade Steve Ballmer for Donald Sterling, the league would have done that a decade ago. You know, but you
but they never felt the impetus to actually do something about it, to actually put up the fight.
Right. And they never put up the fight for things that weren't clear in their area where they were.
And by the
right
way, same with those sponsors who I'm sure knew all of this stuff about Donald Sterling as well.
Right.
They never felt the impetus to take a phony principled stand.
Because people like us, whether us being fans, media, whatever, who also knew about it, didn't really push the issue.
I wrote a piece about this called We Are All Donald Sterling's Mess.
Right.
And there was a wide, white net of complicity that everybody was involved with. I mean, unless you're talking about maybe a few people like Bomani Jones or Jason Whitlock,
people who
out of their way to push this. But for the most part, particularly local media, we didn't do a damn thing about it.
Right. So you have that, and you know, the Cosby thing, now it's gotten to the point where sponsors, Netflix, people who work
NBC.
With Cosby, NBC on a financial and on an entertainment level, now they're all pulling out at a point where clearly they weren't so upset about the allegations from before that they weren't going to work with him again anyway. And so what I think is, you know, the thing that I pull away from it is wondering why certain things, like why now for Cosby? The guy had been performing that routine, he said, I read, you know, in the LA Times, I believe it was, on and off for 6 months. So it's certainly very possible
Hannibal
Buress had been talking about Cosby for 6 months as part of his routine. Somebody heard it. Somebody probably taped it. Somebody probably posted a tape of him doing it.
I'm sure it went to somewhere like Gawker.
Yeah,
that's usually where these things, the origins.
Right, somebody somewhere had posted something somewhere. And why certain things hit and certain things don't, particularly in a time like this where, you know, it can serve a lot of good, I think, in the sense of if you believe Bill Cosby has done wrong, and I do,
as do I,
he will finally be held accountable in one form or another. It could also work the other way, which I find very frightening, because once the narrative gets rolling, you know, and we saw it during the Boston bombing where those two guys were the dudes who blew up the marathon for a little while.
Except
they didn't do it. Unfortunately, you know, their names, their faces weren't out there long enough to become
Richard
a thing.
Jewell happened well before social media was
Imagine what that story would be like now. Why some things hit and some things don't, you know, I wonder if context now, the last 6 to 8 months have been been a time of very heightened awareness of, you know, issue violence towards women, whether emotional violence, physical violence. I wonder if this was just the right time for the Cosby thing to hit. I don't entirely understand why these things do that. That maybe there's a way to control it, maybe there isn't, but that there doesn't seem to be a lot of control, I find to be a scary thing.
It is. I mean, it actually can be. As much as like you and I both agree, this is a comeuppance that Bill Cosby, I think, deserves. And, you know, it's a long time coming for him to be dealing with this. For decades and decades, people knew at the very least, even if you didn't believe rape accusations about him, because, again, these things were reported, people knew that he was a philanderer. He was a very well-known philanderer, had a lot of different issues with a lot of different women, and yet he was still being able to get away with going around lecturing the black community about sexual responsibility. And I think a lot of times people like Bill Cosby, you know, when they engender so much emotional attachment over decades and for different audiences, people often need someone like Bill Cosby to be for them what they need, and they will keep up that lie in their head until a period like right now where they're just forced to confront it. And why that actually happens, like you said, Brian, I don't know. I think the climate that you're describing plays a role in it, but honestly, I think a lot of it's random.
It could be.
I think certainly
things like why the funny cat video, like funny cat video A goes viral while funny cat video B doesn't, I actually heard a really interesting interview with a guy from YouTube whose job it is to try to figure that out. Like, he watches basically everything that's on YouTube and tries to identify and figure out what is going to go viral and what won't. What are the properties that make something go viral and what? Because the benefits for that are obvious. You don't have to explain that. But in this context, because so much now, you know, go look at Ferguson. I mean, we're waiting for to find out whether or not the officer there is going to be indicted or not. So much of the context of these things gets put into the reaction to the reaction. You know, like, how are people going to react to it, and therefore what should be done? NFL has been rightly skewered for constantly reacting to the reaction about Ray Rice,
as opposed to being proactive.
Right, but those things aren't justice necessarily, and so I find it unsettling. It can work in amazing ways in terms of how stories are reported and what's reported and what we find out about
hashtag
people.
Hashtag activism.
Don't.
It can be terrific in some instances.
Someday we're going to be wrong about something, and the consequences for it, and by we I mean everyone, are going to be brutal.
Yeah,
and I so. Let's turn our attention now, Andy, back to Taylor Swift. I'm kidding. It's time now for ACK.
ACK!
And we are doing something a little different, Andy, with ACK. We're going to go with a themed ACK. We're going to try to group some of our questions together in one theme this week. It makes perfect sense. The theme, Andy, is
Thanksgiving.
Because Thursday is Thanksgiving, so a bunch of questions about Thanksgiving.
To begin from... at Andre_CA7, he just goes by Andre, Cam Brothers, will the Lakers win more games than the family and friends at the Thanksgiving table?
Now, let's figure this out here, Andy.
Along with five emojis with tears.
Sad face emojis. Andy, so the first thing I guess we got to do here is figure out who's going to be at the table. So there's you, there's me, our wives, that's four. Our parents are in town, that's six. There are three children, that's
nine. Maybe a friend of your wife's.
And her boyfriend, that would make it 11.
The Lakers, according to my math, I did the math, are currently paced for just under 18 wins. So okay. We'll call it 18.
So right now it appears the Lakers will win more games than the people at our table, but I will say this. The Lakers are fortunate. We have a small family.
I was just going to say, really, that's more a function of us having a very small immediate family. The fact that our mom and dad's side, they've never been terribly close. And we live in California. The majority of our immediate family lives in St. Louis, and they're not going to come visit us. It really has nothing to do with the Lakers, you know, gaining a little steam as the season goes along.
Now, I will say this. I am not totally sure if my aunt and uncle-in-law and my cousin-in-law and their two children are coming. That would add six
Ooh.
People to the count.
Ooh.
And if that's the case, we got a fight on our hands.
That could be
Lakers
a real
pick'em. Versus Thanksgiving table. I would say more Thanksgiving tables than not will have more people at them than Lakers victories this season. Next, ACK, Andy, ACK Cam Brothers. This from Luis Valverde, the real Valverde on Twitter. Have you guys ever waited in line for a Black Friday sale? Any battles while shopping?
God, no. I do not understand people who do this. Like, our wives occasionally have gone with our mom when they've been in town visiting over Thanksgiving.
Right, but you go to the Black Friday sale, like, during that day. Like, you wake up on Friday and you go to Macy's or whatever.
Right, but you're still, I mean, even if you're not waiting overnight, like, you know, for Price is Right tickets or like the place some of those people just be camped around CBS or whatever, even if you're just showing up at, you know, 10 in the morning for one of these sales, it's a jungle, man.
It is. No, it's
That's
hardcore.
A war zone.
It's hardcore, but Andy, there are people who started camping out outside of Best Buys last week.
It's insane.
Some of them have jobs, I presume, where they like took off time.
Had jobs.
No, maybe they took their vacation time to do that, not understanding that they're costing themselves more money than the difference between the price of the TV that they're waiting for.
I mean, the stuff really, to deal with Black Friday, even at its most, I guess, easy, just showing up on Black Friday at a store, that stuff better be free or else I'm just not dealing with it. It's not worth it.
It's not worth it, especially in an era where you can get good prices on Amazon, you can order stuff online. Your time is worth something. I honestly think the people who do this most are the people who really get off on the process of sitting in a parking lot for like a week so that they can say they saved $65 on a television.
By the way, pro tip, if you ever get the email from Jose Bank about the Black Friday sale, you're a fool.
Yeah,
if you
go to that thing. Plenty of sales.
Every day is a sale over at Jose Bank. From at Tackithrader, Tacky C, Cam Brothers, who can eat more in one sitting? Who can drink more in one sitting?
I think this is actually fairly simple. I think I can eat more. Although I'm sure you can pack it away. I think I have probably the patience to go ahead and eat more, but you could definitely drink more. And not only think you can drink more, I think it would be very important to you to prove that you could drink more in this situation.
One could argue, Brian, that my entire life has been spent proving right. that I cannot
preparing
drink you.
Preparing for that moment just in case somebody like Tacky C asked the question.
Now, that actually led to an interest I had in my notes. Who do you think spends more time practicing their craft? You with the eating or me with the drinking?
You with the drinking, for sure.
Really? Because I've seen you around the feed bag there, Porky.
No, I'm not saying that.
That's a year-round sport for you.
But drinking is also something you can't drink. You can eat all day if you want. You can't drink all day like you can eat all day if you want to stay conscious. So, I mean, it's like a per minute kind of thing. It's like a per. Your drinking per is higher than my eating per.
Okay, I see. Unlike Kobe, I'm not sitting out of practice.
No, you're not. Nobody is wondering why Byron isn't giving you more minutes or something like that. I'm not sure I phrased that correctly.
I got it.
Bonus to Tacky C, who asked this question. Do you think Kobe allows anyone to eat during the last 5 minutes of a Thanksgiving dinner? It's just funny. I'm not going to answer that question. Probably not, but it's funny, so it should have been right.
Actually, if that's the case, it's really greedy because he already established that he eats first. Mm-hmm. So at that point, everyone else's Thanksgiving is essentially like halftime.
They can eat the middle.
They don't get to eat at all.
But two good questions from Tacky C this week. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
And finally, we'd like to close this show with a new segment that we call Mitch Kupchak Explains Something.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Brian. Today I will explain where babies come from. As many of you know, men and women have been engaging in romantic relationships for many years, for pleasure and for procreation across all great societies, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Hans, the Mings, the Tangs, the Persians, the Southern Song, the Aztec, the Incas, the Ottomans, the Mongols, the Austro-Hungarian, the British, the Spanish, all had their own sexual customs. And of course, while you can never say exactly how these things happen, because no two blueprints are the same, there are certain commonalities. A man will take his penis and put it inside a woman's vagina. After a certain level of excitement is reached, the man will release his sperm, which can fertilize a woman's egg. Sometimes it's a good egg, sometimes it's a great egg. That egg grows in the woman's uterus, which in pictures looks a little like a cow's head, for over 9 months. Soon a woman's body sends signals it's time for the baby to emerge, and the birthing process begins. Some have told stories about babies being delivered by storks, but that is not true.
There you go.
Mitch Kupchak explains where babies come from. Helpful information, I think, for all. I hope you all learned something.
I know I did.
Some people are afraid to ask these kinds of questions. It's a little embarrassing.
For 3.5 years, I've had a daughter. No clue how that happened.
Thought it was a stork.
Right, but thankfully now,
a trusted confidant like Mitch Kupchak.
Exactly.
The engineer of the Pau Gasol trade.
Exactly.
If anybody's qualified
to answer. I wasn't going to doubt him.
No.
I mean, he pulled off the Pau trade.
seemed pretty accurate to me. All right, so thanks to Mitch for stopping by. Welcome him every week. And again, happy Thanksgiving. Be safe. Enjoy your food. Enjoy your football. Enjoy your family. We'll see everybody next
time. Happy Thanksgiving.